we got to talking about all the things that we wanted to, so I invited her back, and I'm glad to say that Sonia Sanchez is back with me on Fresh Air. Her books include Homecoming, Love Poems, and a Blue Book for Blue Black Magical Women. She's also the author of the play Sister Sanji, which was produced by Joseph Papp at the Public Theater in New York. She's also been a contributing editor for Black Scholar magazine and editor for We Be Word Sorcerers, 25 Stories by Black Americans. Last year, she was awarded the National Endowment of Art Award, and currently she's an associate professor of English at Temple University, and she's a member of the Pennsylvania Council of the Arts. She's just completed a new book that's going to be published any day now. It's called A Sound Investment and Other Stories. It's published by the Third World Press in Chicago. And these are stories that are for children, stories that she initially wrote for her children. Sonia, welcome back to Fresh Air.
Hello, Terry.
Tell us about how you got interested in writing these short stories.
Well, I started to write stories for my children when they were very little. The first one I did was something called The Adventures of Fathead, Smallhead, and Squarehead. And it was merely a story to be very silly at first and whatever. And I remember that the next night they asked me to do that story again. And I had forgotten parts of it. And they found, they said, no, that's not how it goes. And then they told me the story, and then I wrote it down. And, of course, it was published in New York City. And at the end of that story, it's really just basically a fable again, talking about three good friends making a trip. And the whole, in quotes, moral of the story is that two of the friends are very fast. They're very fast at everything that they do. But Fathead is very slow. And, of course, because they're fast, they think that they are better than Fathead. And one of the asides of that story is that when I lived in New York City, I was invited to come out for something called Black History Month at junior high school. And they were celebrating poets from Langston Hughes to the moderns. And they had invited me to come out because they were performing some of my poetry. And two special things happened on that day. Three very young black men, junior high school students, performed a poem of mine that talked about what they didn't want to be. And then at the end, they said what they wanted to be. And they did it in a very jazz-oriented way. It was very, very hip. Every time I read it, I hear them. And afterwards, one came over to me and said, you're Sonia, huh? And I said, yes, I am. He said, well, we didn't think you were going to come. And I said, well, I always try to come when I'm invited and blah, blah, blah. The usual teacher kind of crap. And he said, yeah, right, right. And he says, I want you to know something special about that poem. And part of the poem says, don't want to be a junkie. Because a lot of the poetry I wrote during those days was really to help sustain people, to keep them going, and not to do all kinds of peculiar things. And I said, yes, I heard you do that part. It was very nice. He really wasn't interested in that kind of nice teacher thing that I was doing. He says, what I want you to know is that I was messing around, but after I did that poem, I'm not messing anymore. And it made you understand what poetry is really all about if you really are truly into being a poet. And the other side was reading that story. I was invited to what they call a slow class, whatever that means. I have trouble with that. And in this class was my book. And almost all these students had Fathead. And they were reading the story. And one of them said, the teacher had one of the students stand up. And she was saying, we knew that you wrote this book for us. Because, you see, at the end of the story, I think one of the morals is slow is not always dumb and fast is not always smart. Because with these three friends, Fathead was the only one who survived because he didn't move at a slower pace. But these children who looked at me with so much love and interest said that was their book because they really understood what it was to move at a slower pace. And it didn't mean it was a negative pace or a bad pace. So that was important.
Mm-hmm. As a mother, Sonia, have you had trouble finding books that you'd want to read to your children?
Yes, I really have. And I've just begun. But although I understand the system they go through, and I've got to read them certain kinds of lit. Last night I started to read Poe's The Telltale Heart. And because I read to them at night, and it was really fascinating because afterwards the kids looked at me and said, oh, that was scary. And I said, yeah, you'll read it later on, whatever. But there are certain kinds of things I make an attempt to read to make sure that they hear. And again, I know at some points I would just talk to them at night. I make up things, you know, or I make use of the imagination. I make them, then I start something, make them finish it, which is really kind of interesting. And I get good ideas listening to them sometimes.
I know a lot of your poetry is very political. Do you look for a political point of view in the short stories that you read?
I do. Sometimes I try to give them a wide range of lit. I might read them a lot of maybe Indian folk tales or African folk tales or whatever. Always a lot of stories, sometimes with a moral in Aesop's fables, whatever, because then I need for them to talk about it, to hear certain kinds of things. When I began to write, in quotes, short stories for children, I had to do something with that. For instance, I did the title story in my book, A Sound Investment, came because I heard some of the children talk about not wanting to work. And I thought about the whole ethic of work, that we have not really begun to train our children in terms of, or discuss what work really means, how you develop in terms of doing work, how quite often we as parents, maybe moving on a middle class level, will do everything for our children and then wonder why, one, they can't handle money, or why they really don't have, I mean, I don't want to walk to a store, Ma, drive me to a store, or all those kinds of things. And I began to talk about that. So I did the story, if I can tell you, called A Sound Investment. But one morning, Mrs., and I'm just telling it, I don't have the story with me, Mrs. Green comes downstairs and she looks outside and she says, oh, wow, the lawn is really terrible. The grass is so high. If we don't cut that grass pretty soon, she says, you know, I won't be able to walk outside and neither will you. And I'm heading downtown. When I come back, I like to have the grass cut. So the two children, and I'll use my children's names because I can't think of the names, Mungu and Ronnie, say, yeah, okay, Mom, you know, we'll cut the grass. And she says goodbye. And Mirani goes outside and goes to the garage and takes out the lawnmower. And he says, Mungu, I'll do my half and you do your half. And he says, okay, fine. So he sits down and he watches Mirani. And Mirani begins the long, laborious job of cutting the grass. Mungu then gets up, goes into the house, turns on the idiot box, the television, that is, fixes himself a sandwich, drinks some milk and a sandwich, and stretches out and just enjoys himself for about an hour. Then he slowly he comes outside, you know, he looks at his brother and he sits down, and his brother has almost done his half. And he turns and says, are you about ready? And Mungu says, oh, yes. In fact, he says, I'm noticing just how much I'm helping you. So Mirani turned and said, helping me? How, man? He says, well, I'm helping you because, you know, every time you cut a blade of grass, I'm going, phew. And so his brother says, come on, man, you're always trying to get out of work. I mean, why don't you just stop your jiving and really settle down and think about doing your part of the work? He says, but I am. He says, keep cutting the grass, Mirani, because every time you cut a blade of grass, phew. So Mirani says, are you going to cut the grass? He says, I don't have to. I'm helping you now. If you cut the grass, I'm going, phew, and I'll be helping you. So Mirani finishes cutting the entire lawn, goes inside, and he takes a shower. On his way downstairs, he hears his mother, Mrs. Green, come. You know, she comes in, and she says, oh, wow, the lawn looks terrific, and I'm going to pay the two of you, you know, really give you the reward. He says, no, Mom, you can't pay Mungu, because Mungu did nothing. Mungu says, oh, Mom, no, 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 the cool one. On the contrary, he said, I did half the work. She says, well, Mungu, how could you do half the work if your brother said you didn't help you? And he says, yes, and he didn't even touch the lawnmower. He says, no, Mom, I did half the work. He says, every time Mirani cut a blade of grass, I went, whew, I must have done about 1,000, whew. So she says, oh, I understand. I'll make sure you two get rewarded justly. So Mirani's, but, she says, shh. And they walked into the kitchen. She opened her purse. And she takes out five silver dollars, and she picks up the silver dollar, and she begins to drop the coins on the table. And she turns to Mungu and says, Mungu, the sound of the coins, you know, is yours, but Mirani, the coins are yours. And, you know, it was just that, listening to an argument about work once, that, like, you kind of put it in the back of the head and you walk with it, and sometimes you don't know what to do with it. And all of a sudden it comes to you one day in terms of other kinds of, you know, problems and incidents and whatever. And that came about, and I did that piece. And I thought, at the end, you know, we talk about, you know, why was not really work, and what is work, and give me three reasons why the story is called A Sound Investment, you know. So those kinds of things that will stimulate discussion, you know, among children. So all of the stories have about five questions, so they can be used perhaps in schoolrooms and whatever. And I think that's important. And another one was just a kind of special, soft, gentle one that I did, because one day the children asked me how rain was made. And then, of course, we discussed the very logical, scientific reason. And then I said, but you know, the great thing about writing or even thinking or being a human being is the whole point of, like, after you figure out the scientific reason, then the poetic reason. And I that's why, again, I carry that with me for a while. And this story took me over a year to write, because I would write a little bit and never come back to it. And one day when I was asked about the book, doing the book last year, I said, well, then I have a fifth story for the book. And it was this story, How Rain Was Made. Once long ago, before you and I were born, there was space as there shall forever be space, and there was darkness as there shall always be darkness, and there was water stretching across the earth, but there was no rain. And it came to pass that in the eastern part of the darkness a great light appeared, which hovered above the waters, and a great hotness came from this light. And the light in the darkness began to spin about itself, and became as a great sphere of fire, and shone from east to west, and nothing under the eye was always dark or cold. There was just space, sun, and sea. The days were long and lonely. The sun, sitting high, walked the sky each day in search of someone to talk to. One day, the sun, watching the movement of the waters, said to the sea, "Come near me, that I may see your face, which has been hidden from me since the beginning of the world." And the water, retiring and shy and somewhat afraid of the fire of the sun, said, "Surely, my friend, if I come near you, surely I will destroy you. Instead, I will send one of my workers who will show you the beauty of your face." And so she sent, instead of herself, the vapor of herself. And the vapor of the sea filled the heavens. And the sea sent a gift to the sun, that the sun might be caused to see the great beauty of himself. And through the wetness and moistness of the atmosphere, he eyed the image of himself spread like seven transparent garments of silken luxury. And on the first veil was every manner of red, and on the second every manner of orange, and on the third every manner of yellow, and on the fourth every manner of green, on the fifth every manner of blue, on the sixth every manner of indigo, and on the seventh veil held every manner of purple. And the sun was pleased and beamed with the pleasure of one pleased. Soon the old loneliness returned to the sun, because it was the sea that he wanted in his presence. Not wanting to hurt the vapor of the sea's feeling, he said to her, "Return to your mistress and tell her that I desire to see her face now. Take this gift of heat, this light from myself, which shall follow you to her, then return to me with the answer." And the worker of the sea said to the sun, "It shall be done according to your wishes." But the sun said, "Leave me a token that you will return here as you have promised." And the vapor of the sea left a veil of blue over the heavens as a sign that she would return. And as the vapor returned to the sea, she became rain, and it rained into the sea 40 seasons of time. And the sea greeted the rain with her own tears, for she was saddened because the sun was still not pleased. The sea returned the vapor into the nearness of the sun, and the vapor said, "My mistress is distressed over her inability to please you. She fears, O sun, that she will destroy you, for she cannot come to you in her present form. You are hot and dry, and she, unlike you, is cold and wet. Nor can she show you her face, because her face is beneath her waters, and she has not the power to bring it out from under the veils." And the sun was silent and saddened, and the clouds closed over his face, and the vapor became rain and returned to the sea. But the conversation of the sun and the sea could not be silenced, and they continued to speak through the vapor of the sea, who eternally ran from one to the other. And upon her return home, she brought rain. And that is why there is rain today. That's a kind of very soft poetic piece in terms of why, you know, there's rain today. And I always try to stress, sometimes successfully and sometimes not successfully, the correlation, or the need rather, for always the scientific, but also the creative or spiritual or whatever you want to call it, because I think it's a balance then there in mankind when you have the two. Without it, I think sometimes we, if we lean more to one or the other, you know, meaning we can have many problems, I think.
Do you remember what kind of stories you like to read or have read to you when you were young?
Well, I didn't have many. I remember I didn't have many stories read to me when I was a child. I learned how to read very young, when I was about 3 or 4. I was reading. I was a very quiet child. As a child, I stuttered a great deal. And so I never, I don't remember people, you know, coming reading to me, but I do remember being given books, and I don't remember anyone teaching me how to read. I just remember that at some point I was reading, and I guess someone did show me words or whatever, and when I went to school, I was a reader, and I've always been, I guess because I was a stutterer and a very quiet, retiring person, and a lot of that is, you know, I put a lot of me in there. I did read a lot. And I read everything that was, you know, anyone had, you name it. I went through my smutty period, you know, when I was in junior high school, where I read everything that was in quotes dirty, you know, whatever. But the point is that I always tell people, because I remember that time that I went to the library every day, and you name it, if it's whatever it was, you know, whatever book, Forever Amber, you know, at the time was popular, whatever, I got any book like that. We have to kind of like, in a sense, know that sometimes children read nothing but books on baseball or football or whatever, but just bear with it. They move out to other kinds of things too. And one of the reasons why I read to them at night is to help them make that move sometimes when they get fixated, you know, at a lot of sports things and whatever. I'll pick up a book and begin to read, you know, to them. About 2 weeks ago, I was reading them a book on Paul Robeson's life. And then to supplement that, sometimes when we sit down to eat, I put on a record of Paul Robeson, and he was doing parts of Othello. And, I mean, not that I expected them to understand all that that was about, but at least, you know, that is there. That kind of motion and movement is there. And they listen to it and they hear it, which I think is important.
Would you ever censor books that your kids are reading and advise them to not read it?
I doubt it. I doubt it. I think what I would do is that after they read it, I think we would talk about, you know, or I might even, in a sense, give them an introduction as to what the book might be about, et cetera, and what to look for. I think that's important, to always tell children what to look for. And then when they finish, you know, in a sense, talk about it. I mean, a very long, especially some books, I think you would just say, let's talk about it. It's like sometimes I try not to censor television programs, but I will make a point to sit down. I mean, some things I say is junk and you don't watch on that level, whatever. I mean, it's not worth the time. But sometimes if I think things are going to be controversial, I'll sit down and say, let's do this one together and see what's happening. And I think that's important. My children wanted to see Star Wars, and some people had seen it and said they thought it was a waste of time. I mean, they had scientific things and whatever. But they want a person has said, but you know, there's something interesting in that flick. You know, there are no black people in there, you know, and how can you be talking about future times and you don't see yourself and the children? But, you know, we're talking about children who are involved with, like, other children going to school and whatever. And everyone had seen that movie. So I said, okay, sure, I won't just take you there and drop you and come pick you up. I'll go sit with you. So on the way home, I had some very concrete things to say about it. And they said, oh, Ma, you know, Ma, you know, everything, you know, there's always something, you know, there. And I said, okay, because I think we must also learn how to back up a little bit with children, you know, because like you can't turn them off. So I said, okay. Well, my children are avid football players now, since, you know, they're boys, and I never was, but now I kind of stretch out on the couch on Sundays and stretch out, you know, during the winter time, and we watch football. And this particular day, I had popcorn, and we were stretched out talking, and a guy by the name of Sistrom, Otis Sistrom, who plays for Oakland Raiders, I think, whatever. I mean, I kind of like know some of them now, but I think he is a bald head. He had just done a very heavy thing, you know, like, and he was really bad, and the kids would say, ooh, yes, he's really bad and whatever. And I, you know, in my own way, enjoying it, but like, you know, sometimes wishing, you know, I was upstairs someplace, whatever. The cameraman zoomed in on Sistrom, right? And on his bald head, and the two commentators, one of them said, doesn't he look like something just out of Star Wars? Whew. And my head, which was kind of nodding like, you know, popped up, and the children looked up, and nothing else needed to be said. I mean, I think that what happens in this society is the following, that like, you can talk a great deal and you can push, you know, at some point you withdraw with your children, or you back up rather, if not withdraw. And I think that what happens here, that other things will make sure, will in a sense, confirm or reaffirm what you're saying. You know what I'm saying? It was just like something will happen at some point, and then you can open up the discussion again.
Mm-hmm.
We just have to kind of like wait for it. Of course, I got on the telephone and call and complain, you know, to the television station, but you know what that's about. Oh, thank you, madam. You know, whatever. But that was a very real situation right there. You know, and we had, then the whole conversation came up again about the little people, you know, and the weird kind of little, you know, gibberish. And the Rolling Stones had done a long article on how they had come up with the gibberish that the people were talking.
Oh, right,
you know,
movie, yeah.
Yeah, and the kind of combination of African dialects and whatever that had happened. So, like, you know, then a much deeper discussion came about, and I didn't even initiate it. So sometimes you can't always, I want to, but sometimes I've learned now as they get older to hold back on certain kinds of discussions and then just let other things naturally occur. Because we can become too feverish, you know, in a sense. And the kids will say, oh, Ma, you know.
Yeah. Where are you sending them to school?
They're going to one of the Amy schools here.
Amy
school? Yeah, it's a middle years, alternative middle years. And it's a public school, and it goes from 6th to 8th. You know, they're both, you know, they're together, and they're hanging in. And, you know, you hope that they pull through. I think that you have to do a lot of extra work always with your children. I think that's really important to do that kind of thing. And I don't know exactly where they'll go to high school. You know, I don't know if one will have to regroup and talk about private high schools or whatever, if you're talking about perhaps, you know, university life or whatever, or if you're talking about sending them out the country to school. I think there are some options probably, you know, there.
So out of the country or out into the country?
Out of the country, right.
You have your eyes on certain countries?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, there are countries that, you know, people have, you know, just decided sometimes in terms of, like, just even education alone and expense, you know, in terms of money, but in terms of trying to continue to raise political children, that they've just said, you know, perhaps it's wise to do that. But it's, I have a little ways to go, so I'm going to just, you know, kind of play with it and think about it.
Sonia Sanchez is my guest, if you're just joining us, and if you tuned in while she was reading one of her stories, a bunch of short stories for children are just about to be published. The book should be out any day now, and the book is called A Sound Investment and Other Stories, and it's published by the Third World Press in Chicago. Sonia, I'd like to talk about your poetry a little
mm-hmm.
bit. A lot of your poetry is political,
mm-hmm.
and I wonder if you think that it's a different process at all evaluating a political poem than evaluating just a poem about something that doesn't have a political point of view to it, in the sense that there's a lot of art that has good politics but isn't necessarily good art.
Mm-hmm.
How do you reconcile that? How do you, what do you,
well, there's some,
do you judge the two independently, the political content and the form or structure?
No, I think that what I've done in terms of writing, they have been poems that I have composed on the spot when certain things, you know, have happened, have occurred. Gwen Brooks, Hakeem Adebutu, Don Lee, and I were had gone to a school for Black History Month together, and I went into a classroom, and in this classroom, a little a black girl had been called, and I can't say the word because your audience, you little yellow so-and-so, you, whatever, you know? And she started to cry. And then the teacher heard it, turned around and said, shh, I'm teaching math, she said, because these people are here to teach, you know, to read some poetry, to teach some poetry, whatever, she said, I got to get through it. But I saw that child put her head down and cry, and the children were laughing at her. And that was she learned no math. She learned nothing. I mean, she learned nothing except that experience at that particular point. So what I did is I did a poem for her and read it first time off, not in the sense of like trying to do a great artistic piece, but because it's what I call, or someone else call, and anyway, people, a lot of people I know who write, a throwaway poem, a poem that was used for a specific point to make a very specific, you know, point at that time. And it was important for that classroom to hear it. And I did a poem for a collection for a short for junior high school students. And it goes, I think if I can remember part of it, and I'm very bad. If I had the book here, I would be able to say it. I think something like High Yellow high yellow black girl, walking like the sun you be, move on even higher. Those who laugh at your blackness have not moved to the blackness we be about, cause, and I forget part of it, but the point was that it was a teaching kind of poem, completely, you know, and it taught, and when I read it, the children then started a discussion. And then their conscience was investigated, and they began to talk about what that was really all about. And we talked about the varying shades of blackness that we are, and the beauty of it. And so we didn't just talk about a little simple thing like black is beautiful, but I mean there are varying shades of blackness, you know, that exists, etc. And no one from high yellow to the deepest black, blue black, okay, is more beautiful than anyone else. You see, and that was important. I didn't consider it a great poem, but I did consider it an important poem because of what it did and how it helped. And I've seen that kind of thing, and I've done poems consciously, you know, to do that, because I knew the need. I heard the need. I did poems about drugs, very conscious poems about drugs, because living in New York City and living in Harlem, in the Harlems of the world. I mean, I lived in Harlem, and living in places where you walk out and you just saw young people just so strung out that when you went into junior high schools and elementary schools and high schools, and people would actually walk up to you and say, could you write a poem about drugs? I mean, people would ask you, and the need was there. And I said, like, a very fast, yes, I will. And the need for those poems were there. And so, like, I did it. So, like, when the young black men did Don't Want to Be No Pimp, because pimps hate me and you, their mamas, women, sisters too. You name it, any hate will do. Don't want to be no pimp no more. Don't want to be no pimp no more. Don't want to be no numbers runners, you know. And then don't want to be no junkie, because junkies kill they selves, you and me, they mama. Women, sisters, too. You name it, anyone will do. Don't want to be no junkie no more. Don't want to be no junkie no more. Just want to be a Malcolm man, a Paul Robeson man. And you went on, you know, and you began to talk to him. And to see the experience of young people being told the kind of man that they could be, as opposed to a numbers runner, a junkie, a pimp in the neighborhood where I grew up, you know, in Harlem. I mean, the pimp was like a heavy dude. I mean, the image, he was the one in the fine clothes, the fine threads, you know, and he was like the car and the women, you know, and he looked bad. And that was very real. And he was much more glamorous than the fathers who went off, you know, in the work clothes, coming home, you know, tired, you know, grimy, whatever. The numbers runner was another one. He was cool. He was a cool dude. But they were allowed to be in that community, you see, on a very obvious level and for very obvious reasons, you see. And so I was saying here now, in this 60s, late 60s, early 70s time, you don't want to be that, you know. And then if you don't want to be that, then you say to a country, then that's not all I will be. Okay, and I can be other things, and I'm willing to do the work for that. So discussions came out. So those were poems that I did consciously, on purpose. And I think that what I'm saying full circle is that, no, I don't think one needs to change the criteria for examining a political poem, you know, or a non-political poem, because I believe all poems are political. I think some poems just keep to the status quo. And then some talk about change. The poems that keep to the status quo, you know, can very often run amok, you know, in terms of certain kinds of styles and certain kinds of form or whatever. Quite often, a lot of the so-called political poetry has reveled in free verse, etc., you know, and has made great use of that, you know, has broken down many forms, you know, have violated forms, you know, etc. So, no, I don't think so. I think that, like, you know, when Neruda, you know, got that award. I mean, it broke down the whole image of, like, political poets, you know, were not good, etc. But I think that what many countries do simply is that they say that to keep people saying, if you want to write really good, pure poetry, stay away from political themes. And I think that people have, like, in a sense, denied that, because I think women poets, some of the most exciting writers today are women poets. And I think what we're saying at this particular point is that they're writing political things, and they are indeed exciting poets. And I think they're important kinds of things. And I think, again, they have broken certain, you know, certain kinds of boundaries. And they're writing good poetry, too. So I think a lot of black poets wrote fantastic poetry, and they broke, you know, they made use of folklore. I have in my poetry, I made use of what we call street talk and tried to dignify it, to say that it's worthy of a poem. So you broke certain traditions, and in breaking certain traditions, people will slap your hand and say, well, you can't do that. It's not really great poetry. And I think that most of us will never, I mean, some might write, if we write one great poem in our lifetime, we're lucky. So I don't think that's really the criteria. The point is that, am I as a poet doing what I'm supposed to do as a human being? And that is, am I really writing as well as I can, as I can or could? And secondly, am I really saying something to people? Am I just saying to people like things are just okay the way they are, and people are looking at their lives and they know almost, you know, they know that it's not? Or am I, in a sense, bringing some kind of beauty to them, or an idea of change to them in the midst of beauty and non-beauty? And I think that's what I've tried to do. And it's not always easy, but it's a challenge, I think, always.
I know I've had some difficulties with some music, for instance, where I really liked the music. I really liked the tune, the way it was played, the musicianship, the rhythm. But if there's a lot of tunes that have lyrics to it where I really hate the lyrics, the message of it just really irritates me. But the musical part works fine. So there's this discrepancy between the content and the form.
I think a lot of people who could write the lyrics for that music aren't asked to do it. I think a lot of people see that. That's like, I teach writing. I teach poetry, okay? I do a lot of workshops. And people think because they can write a poem or whatever, okay, that they're poets, you know? And it's training. One of the things, the hardest thing I can do in a semester is to make students understand that poems, you can regurgitate lines, but it does not mean that it really is a poem, or it has developed as a poem, or it's like really has developed all that it should have developed, okay? Because the lines are there, I don't want to mess with it. It's purely pure now. I say, yes, it is purely pure, but it's so full of pure crap sometimes too, that one needs to like deal with that and wash away some of the crap and really get down to what it really is, purely pure. And I guess in the society, because people have can write some lines, they will say that they're poets. And in quotes, the people who really work at their craft understand the need for discipline and the need to rework and rework. I mean, I have reworked things for months, you know, and in fact, for years, in fact, okay, until I finally said, okay, here you are, you know. And that's very hard to always explain to people, because especially young people, I mean, it's finished, and what else could I do to it? And to always say to someone, but it's not working, you know, it's not, oh, you're not really saying, or you don't touch anything, or you're saying exactly what has been said before in the same manner. How can you say that in a different way where you touch a new chord, you see? That's the hard job, I think, quite often.
What I'm referring to with the example of tunes where the musicianship is good and the music's good, but the lyrics are terrible, is a discrepancy that I sometimes feel with art or music whose message I don't relate to, but I like it anyways, and you just don't know what to do sometimes, how to react to something when politically the message doesn't work for you or makes you really angry, but the music or the use of words or whatever works just fine for you. Do you ever experience that kind of thing with poetry or literature or music?
Well, I've experienced, listening to the radio and listening to poetry put to music, in a sense, you know, for a message, and it's not done well. I mean, they use the simple rhymes, the simple kinds of things, and my ear hears so much more, and how much more important it could be if other things were done. But I think we've got to understand that I guess in any art form, I guess the poet is always, in a sense, most people think they can be poets. You know, and that's a weird kind of thing. People, as I said before, I've experienced this. People write one poem. I go places and people have written one poem. So can I read my poem? You know, and you say, sure you can. And people will clap and they feel good and whatever. And I think that, like, that's good. I think that as long as we keep an appreciation of poetry going, that's important. But then we have to take people a step further than that. And the step further sometimes is, like, of course, getting people in workshops or in classes and then say, okay, you said that, now let's, you know, move someplace else. I hear people who say certain things and they say it in a very simplistic way. And you do want to grab people sometimes and say, come on, you know, here's my hand. Let me, you know, say something else at this point, or teach you how something, how another form would even make it even much more important, or how even the reliance on rhyme is really not necessary in a piece like this, or there are all kinds of rhymes, you know, whatever. But you don't always get an opportunity, you know, to do that kind of thing. But I mean, I don't get annoyed as much as I want to help. You know, I mean, to open up the brain, you know, to like other possibilities in terms of poetry.
Sonia, how do you feel about being called a black poet? Do you like to be called a black poet, or do you prefer just poet?
I think that being called a black poet. In fact, I'm usually called. I always put down the thing black woman poet, and I always.
I was going to get to that
yeah,
next.
Right. And I think that, like, it fully describes me. You know, I think that we're living in a world that is a peculiar world. We listen to people talk about moving towards a humane society, whatever. And I think that the reason why people say black poet today or black woman poet is that because they are, in a sense, saying something, making a positive statement. You know, quite often, if one ever reads Langston Hughes and a manifesto that he did some years ago, where he said that, like, you know, there's nothing wrong with being called a black poet. In fact, it's a beautiful idea to want to celebrate the blackness that we all have. And I'm utterly amazed at people who say, well, just call me poet, whatever. And I think until we evolve, you know, to a point where we can all say, well, we're all poets, you know, and we're not so involved so much with, like, what people are about, you know, or even their history. If we really truly ever become that society that we have, like, supposedly America is aiming for, then I think probably to say you're a black poet is not militant, or is not negative, you know, or it's not anything other than, like, what you really are, where you come from. And I know I read in one of the books that we have, the Norden Anthology of Poetry, Audrey and Rich talks about in an essay that because there were women, black women and black men who were able to step out and say, I'm a black poet, then women were able to say, I'm a woman poet. You know, and that was a deep thing, she said, because, I mean, like, you were a poet, but, like, you hated to admit that you were a woman poet. You know what I'm saying? Like, I'm here, but, like, I'll try not even to even bother you with the idea of my womanness. And what the heck? You know, if you are a woman, you know, and if you are a black poet, you know, whatever, then, like, be happy about it. And so that was an interesting kind of feeling that one got from reading the essay, is that she said, you know, because people dare to do things, then someone else could dare to do that. And I think that's important sometimes. Now, I mean, 25 years from now, it might not be equally as important. But in terms of a whole process that goes on, you know, everything goes in cycles and movements, you know, will not be necessary perhaps 25 years from now, but at a time to bring people to other kinds of things, you make use of it.
Do you feel comfortable at group readings, for instance, that are called, like, readings of women poets?
Oh, sure.
Are you comfortable with that?
Yeah, I have no problem with reading with people. You know, some people won't read with groups, you know.
So I'm saying some people don't like to be categorized in any category. Some people don't prefer not to have a women's heading or a black heading or
right.
any kind of...
So if someone says a black woman poet, you know, sometimes I go places, they say poet Sonia Sanchez, you know. It depends on what they're into. I always know what I'm into and feel comfortable with it. So I always know that I can always, in a sense, you know, rearrange, you know, whatever needs to be rearranged, or say what I need to say. And I think people can look at you and see also, you know, who you are, you know, as I say, who you be, you know, and that's important too.
Have you been involved with feminism at all, or has that affected your life in any way?
Well, I think that feminism or the women's movement or whatever, I think that being a woman, you've got to understand exactly that whatever's happening as far as other women, that it affects you. That I think that I've been involved in course with feminism for a long time, because, like, even in terms of being involved with black poetry as such, I mean, I was reading with a lot of men, and sometimes would be the only woman reading with a bunch of men. And sometimes they were put downs, you know, and I would just remind people that, like, whatever, I mean, I was reading was equally as important as anyone else. So you were always, like, out there. People will say, well, you know, Sonia, the solution. In fact, I can't find that poem. Someone said once about me, because I was, in quotes, a political poet, and they said, well, you know, the solution to Sonia Sanchez is is to have some babies. And I said, well, I already have babies, you know, children, whatever. But I'm just saying, and it was interesting. And I said, and I did a long poem called The Solution to Sonia Sanchez, very heavy, you know, really a hard-hitting kind of poem. And what I think that, like, people had to grow in this society, men and women. And a lot of the old attitudes about women is that, like, they were women poets, or to be a good woman poet, you had to have, like, probably a good a male poet lover, or to get even published, you had, I mean, we had to go through some very strange things. And I decided that, like, if I am going to get published, it's going to be the way I want to get published. And that was, like, real, if that was feminism, that was, like, understanding that, like, you know, I am here, if I want to do this, I'll do it, if I don't want to do it, you know, but don't tell me I need to do that for a book. If you understand truly what I'm saying. And it was a very hard set. It was not easy. But I think I was in San Francisco. I told you the last time in the program, and I saw the women's movement begin to move there. I went over to Berkeley and spoke to some women who were beginning to say, we've seen some of the black women who are asserting themselves, and they were in the process of doing the same thing. So we had workshops, you know, we had talks together. And so I was at the beginning looking at it. I saw many of the problems involved with it in terms of, like, a lot of middle class things happening and whatever, and also understood that, like, it really could be a truly progressive movement. And I realized watching America that it was going to, like, get a lot of stopgaps in there, so it wouldn't become progressive. But I think eventually that it probably will. I mean, some progressive things in terms of the taking care of children and whatever, you know. But I think it will move on another level too eventually.
I know a lot of black women feel that feminism is something for white women.
I think only because, like, the way it began, and also the women who moved into it in the beginning. I think what they're talking about is that any movement is important if you're a woman too. Anything that says woman, you know, has got to involve you, and any of the things that come out of that. I think what many of them are saying too, the ones who are political perhaps, is that, like, the ideas that the feminists have picked up, anti-male ideas, a lot of the women don't even pick those ideas up. And I said, once I think those things are straightened out, people can move in and out of the movement, you know, back and forth without any kind of stress and strain. But it has got to be straightened out, I think. And I think that's important in terms of dialogue.
Do you think it would work for black women and white women to get together? Because that hasn't really happened much.
It hasn't happened, but it has happened with some people, with some women, you know, who are artists. With some women who are political, it has happened. I go to New York and I read for a lot of political people, you know, period. And I think that it will happen eventually, because I think when we look at what is happening here in America, that there is a real move towards the right. And you're going to look up and find not too many people who are progressive, you know, moving in a progressive manner. And it's going to mean you're going to have to look up and say, well, who are the progressive people? And also when you travel in the world, I think that, like, you look up and see that, like, you end up in a place like Cuba or Africa or wherever, you just see people who are progressive, you know, who are all kinds of shades, you know, all colors, et cetera. And I think that helps a lot with growth, et cetera. I think that's very important. But I think that this country has isolated a lot of blacks, you know, for so many years. Like, the beauty of Paul Robeson, I think, is that kind of beauty. Is that, like, because he was able to move in and out of various groups, you know, that his work was very, he was a very important man, you see, that he was able to, like, bring people together and whatever. And that's something that you learn eventually how to do, and you learn the worth of that also. And he stayed a political man to the end. That's important. But I think it's not a simple solution, and I don't think we need to move towards simplistic kinds of statements. I think that, like, many things will happen in this country out of necessity.
Sonia, can you read some poems for us?
Sure, I'd like to.
Sonia Sanchez is my guest, if you're just joining us. She's a poet, and she's just also written a book of short stories for children that's about to be published, and that's called A Sound Investment and Other Stories. She's lives in Philadelphia now and is on the faculty of Temple University.
I think the last time I was here, did I read the poem to Shirley Graham Du Bois the last time I was here?
No, I don't think so.
I guess I want to read it because it's Marge, and, you know, Shirley Graham Du Bois, the wife of W.E.B. Du Bois, died in the People's Republic of China, March 27th, 1977. And I met Shirley Graham Du Bois when I was teaching at Amherst College. She had come up to teach at UMass. And she just changed my entire life, you know, when I met her there in Amherst. And so I did a poem for her and my mother The two of them both died of cancer in 1977. And the title is called Kwa Mama Zetu Walio Tuzea, which merely means for our mothers who gave us birth. Olakun means goddess of the sea. Death is a 5 o'clock door, forever changing time. And it was morning without sun or shadow, a morning already afternoon, sky cloudy with incense. And it was morning, male in speech, feminine in memory. But I am speaking of everyday occurrences, of days unrolling bandages for civilized wounds, of gaudy women chanting rituals under a waterfall of stars, of men freezing their spurns in diamond-studded wounds, of children abandoned to a curfew of marble. As morning is the same as night, death and life are one, spring, settling down on you like green dust, mother, ambushed by pain and runes, bloated with a century of cancer. Your face, a scattered cry from Kwikwek's wooden bar, mother, I call out to you, traveling up the Congo. I am preparing a place for you. Night, made of female rain, I am ready to sing her song, prepare a place for her. She comes to you out of turquoise pain. Restring her eyes for me, restring her body for me, restring her peace for me. No longer full of pain may she walk, bright with iron smiles may she walk, as it was long ago may she walk. Abundant with lightning steps may she walk, abundant with green trails may she walk, abundant with rainbows may she walk, as it was long ago may she walk. At the center of death is birth. In those days when Amherst, fertilized by black mist, rerouted the Nile, you became the word, Shirley Graham Du Bois. You were the dance pyramidal sister. You told us in what Egypt our feet were chained. You, trained in the world's studio, painted the day with palaces, and before you marched the breath of our ancestors, and your laughter, passing through a village of blacks, scattered the dead faces, and your voice, lingering like a shy goat, fed our sad hungers. And I, what Pennsylvania day was I sucking dry, while you stuttering a thousand cries hung your breasts on pagodas? And I, what dreams had I suspended above our short order lives, when death showered you with bells? Bells, 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 call her back for me, bells. Call back this memory still fresh with cactus pain. Call her name again, bells. Shirley Graham Du Bois has died in China, and her death demands a capsizing of tides. Olukun, 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 she is passing your way while pilgrim waves whistle complaints to man. Olukun, 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 a bearer of roots is walking inside of you. Prepare the morning nets to receive her. Before her peace, I know no thirst because of her. Behind her peace, I know beauty because of her. Under her peace, I know not fear because of her. Over her peace, I am wealthy because of her. Death is coming. Death is coming, death is coming, death is coming, death is coming. The whole world hears the buffalo walk of death passing through the archway of new life. The day is singing, the day is singing, he is singing in the mountains. The night is singing, she is singing. In the earth, I am circling new boundaries. I have been trailing the ornamental songs of death, life, a strong pine tree dancing in the wind. I inhale the ancient black breath, cry for every dying living creature. Come, 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 you, me, you, me, you, 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 me, you, 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 me, you, 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 me, you, you, me, you, 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 you. Let us ascend from the middle of our breath, sacred rhythms. Inhaling peace. That's a kind of special poem for my mother and Shirley Graham Du Bois. And it's called Kwa Mama Zetu Walio Tuzea, for our mothers who gave us birth, because, you know, we take that kind of spirit and love and substance from people who've gone before. And that's the worth, I think, of people, you know, when they live in the time that they live, that they give that kind of substance to people so they also can take it and move on. and live and be.
Nice poem. I'm glad you read it.
Thank you.
Do you watch much television and go to the movies much? Do you have any feelings about what black people are being portrayed now on television?
I watch
new serials with.
Yeah, I watch it every now and then. Not much. sees usually the usual kind of stuff on television. That is, usually the black woman is a sexy singer, you know, with the tight dress on and whatever, and she's singing something special and moving, the behind and whatever, and usually one sees the black man on television as an athlete, you know, that he's either boxing now, or running with a football, etc. But no serious kinds of things, do you really see? And, he's funny. You know, he's like, real kind of funny dude, with a funny kind of word, et cetera. You know, even from the little kids on down, little black kids are the ones who are a smart alecky, and they have the smart kind of sayings, back and forth. And I think that's interesting. And when children want to see something that's really serious, they turn the channel and will watch maybe a Little House on the Prairie or something where you have children involved with real kinds of things. But, otherwise you turn it on, you watch little black kids like saying Slap Me Five and Yell Man, but nothing involved, any kind of serious kind of movement, et cetera. And that's tragic on many levels. But it keeps people, I guess, fixated, at in an abnormal way, always the fun kinds of things, et cetera. But television, perpetuates a certain image, and the image of black people on television has not always been good. The image of the Mexican was always sitting with a sombrero, lazy, and in the sun and whatever, everyone's, bustling around in the sun, but this Mexican is taking, his siesta, but anyone with any sense in those countries would know that when that sun is high noon, anyone with any sense will take a nap and not get out into the sun, or the big heavy sex symbol, with the slick hair and don't leave your daughter, with them kind of image. And the same thing in terms of the black woman in all the movies, she's either the big sex symbol with the red dress on with the Dorothy Dandridge type, or the Lena Horne type years ago, or the big fat mammy type in Gone with the Wind, Oh, yes, Miss Lucy, honey child, of course I'm going to take care of you and your 25 children, right? I leave my 35 at home, and you don't have to pay me anything for it. I mean, that's that kind of fantastic image. And it satisfies people's, idea of the black woman, coming out of slavery in this country, that you one or the other. You were not never the in-between, hardworking. And Abby Lincoln, in Nothing But a Man, some years ago, portrayed, and that black man also was seen as a hardworking man, etc. But a love story that was very beautiful and very pretty, there. And I know that, understanding America and understand the many roles that black men play, I go into prisons to read poetry and whatever. And I was coming out of one of the prisons around here, close by, and one of the men told me that, that the majority of black men in here are Vietnam veterans, the ones, and we don't hear that story of people who've gone away to fight a war and come back, drug problems and all kinds of things, prepared for what, they were prepared to kill, but prepared for how to enter the society here. Those are fantastic stories that, many of us want to write, and it needs to be written in terms of what really happens, get involved with that kind of thing so people can understand what that really means and what that has meant. But it's not allowed, because I think it's important for a society that is moving the way that it is to always keep the funny man, the funny black man, the funny black child, the sex symbol as such, up there, because it's important that happened. And if you're going to try to change it, something else will happen in terms of society and people's heads. And you and I know that television or the movies has never played a primary role in changing those ideas that exist here.
Michelle Wallace wrote a book in which she suggests that a lot of the movie stereotypes of women, of either the the saucy temptress or the big maternal maid type has really had a strong effect on black women growing up in the country, because those were the two main models that were offered.
Well, you either saw Lena Horne on the screen. If you didn't look like Lena Horne, you know, by golly, by gee, that, you know, you went home crushed, you know. And the other one was Hattie McDaniel.
Right.
You know, the big fat mammy, and you knew you didn't look like that as such. But also, what that meant is that, like, people who did look like Hattie McDaniel, can you imagine how they felt about themselves? I mean, it's a very heavy thing there. And there were no in-betweens. And you and I know there are in-betweens. But it's satisfied, you know, that which America was trying to, you know, throw out there, that, like, you were either a whore, you know, or you were indeed the maid, the worker, you see. And so you couldn't be the mother. You couldn't be the lover in between, or just an ordinary kind of woman, or you couldn't be any of those other things that we knew when we saw our parents, when we saw our mothers, you know. We knew what they were. We saw that, but you didn't ever see her up on the screen. And that was kind of hard. So it was a funny image that you had, you know, growing up. So then you identified with those women on the screen, you know, and you wanted to be like them. Because you never wanted to be, I mean, you might want to be like Lena Horne, but you couldn't if you didn't look like her. You see, so already that was, you know. You pushed that aside. You didn't want to be Hattie McDaniels, you know, whatever, for whatever reasons there, et cetera. So therefore, there you were, you see.
Yeah.
So you began to identify with others. And you began, by that process, you denied yourself, and you disliked yourself, too. It's a whole kind of funny process came down.
Sonia, we're just about out of time. Mm-hmm. I was wondering if you have any projects in the works now.
Yes, you know, I've been writing on a novel for, you know, quite a while. And I think what I need is just the time to get that done. Period. And I need a long stretch of maybe 6 months at some point to do that. And I've started a new book of poetry. It's a collection dedicated to my father, but also about my father, a Southern black man, and what that meant to be a Southern black man, and the movement north, and I guess his producing my sister, myself, and then my producing my children. And it's called Home Girls and Hand Grenades. And I've started to work on that. And that always keeps me going when I'm working, you know. Terry, it's like you work. And so you can continue to go because you do work. You do write.
Well, good luck with it.
Thank you.
I've been with Sonia Sanchez, who is a poet and a teacher at Temple University, where she is on the faculty of the English department. She also writes short stories, and if you're interested in children's short stories, Sonia has a book that's going to be published any day now called A Sound Investment and Other Stories, stories that she originally wrote for her own children, and they're just about to be published by the Third World Press in Chicago. Well, that's it for this afternoon's Fresh Air. Tomorrow afternoon at 2 o'clock, we'll have a panel discussion on violence and pornography and the First Amendment and all the questions that are raised when the three of those come together. So that will be at 2 o'clock tomorrow afternoon on Fresh Air. I hope you can join us then. Technical director for this afternoon's Fresh Air has been Joyce Lieberman and Paul Keller. The associate producer of Fresh Air is Danny Miller. Contributing today was Francis Davis. My name's Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. Hope you have a real good evening. WUHY-FM in Philadelphia, where listener-supported public radio in the Delaware Valley.
Good evening from National Public Radio in Washington. I'm Steve Curwood.
And I'm Susan Stamberg with All Things Considered.
The Secretary of State, the President, these are the people that have all the facts. We have someone there we love very much. I think we have to listen to them. We have to go by their decisions. You still want to do something, anything, but I think it's better to be patient and to wait than to do something that would backfire.
Dorothea Moorfield, wife of the U.S. Consul General in Iran, one of the hostages at the American Embassy. Tonight on All Things Considered, the wife of a hostage supports the U.S. effort in Iran, and Secretary of State Cyrus Vance goes to the United Nations.
Also tonight, these stories, Jimmy Carter and Ronald Reagan sweep the southern primaries.
President Carter puts finishing touches on his inflation-fighting plan.
Economist Barry Bosworth has his own ideas.
Commentator Daniel Shore says security advisor Brzezinski is talking about negotiation for a neutral Afghanistan.
Notes on television's impact on the imagination.
Cracker Jack's 109 years old and still giving prizes.
And we observe the birthday of the late Jack Kerouac.
That and more on All Things Considered. First, Diane Diamond has this news.
Vance and Waldheim met today at the United Nations. The Secretary of State and the UN Secretary General discussed the UN diplomatic effort to free the American hostages in Iran. That effort has not gone well. The UN commission sent to Tehran to hear Iranian grievances and to meet with the American hostages was prevented from visiting the U.S. Embassy. The panel did get to see three of the American hostages, though,